This is David DeGraw versus 8th Judicial District Court, State of Nevada, and Misty DeGraw, case number 72528. We had requests from Amiki, which we granted. It was originally a 30-minute argument. It's now 40 minutes, and we will have, of course, on behalf of Mr. Picard, on behalf of the petitioner, beginning.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice and Justices of the Court. Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Keith Pickard. I represent the appellant in the matter, David DeGraw, and I will request to reserve 3 minutes of time for rebuttal, and the Court will allow it 4 minutes to amicus counsel, as he's going to be better suited and in a position to represent the interests of the legislature better than I. The issues before the Court today and it is a matter of first impression, is whether the District Court erred in holding the legislative continuance statute found in NRS 1.310 is an impermissible intrusion of the legislature upon the inherent power of the judiciary to govern its procedures. The proposed resolution of this case is a practical one. The Court can adhere to the canon of constitutional avoidance and construe the statute to be susceptible to denial of a continuance in emergency or extraordinary circumstances. The District Courts can follow a process akin to temporary restraining orders, whereby the movement must show that irreparable harm will obtain without the denial, and that the movement is likely to succeed on the merits. The trial court should thereafter decide the motion on the pleadings consistent with or analogous to EDCR 2.23, meaning the pleadings must contain a clear prima facie case for denial because of emergency or extraordinary circumstances that would otherwise result in irreparable harm, and with such documentary evidence and proffered exhibits supporting the claims. This case was not an emergency, nor is it one where truly irreparable harm would have obtained. Mom, the real party in interest, already exercised significant parenting time in a timeshare she negotiated.
Mr. Pickard, why isn't the case moot at this stage? If the court were to adopt the approach that you've suggested, which is a little bit different than what you suggested in your opening brief, in the way of interpreting the statute, it is predicated on the existence of an emergency or some extraordinary circumstance. In this case, we're way past that. And so I worry a little bit about venturing into an opinion that addresses the statute when the underlying record raises a question about whether that even exists. And I'm sure we're going to hear from Mr. Blackham that there was an emergency, or at least from his point of view, the custody of the child and the status of the child, custody was an emergency issue. But I'm concerned about whether this is now rendered moot. Could you address that, please, before you get into your remaining arguments?
Certainly, Your Honor. The case itself has been resolved. The parties resolved it themselves for the most part. And that really, as we, in our response to the order to show cause on this issue, this is a case that is certainly capable of repetition. In fact, with at least a dozen filed attorneys looking to, or a dozen seats in the legislature that are being sought by currently practicing attorneys, we anticipate this will be an issue. Ultimately, I think that this speaks to the idea that was brought up in Ryan's Express v. Amador Stage Lines, where we talked about the fact that lawyers are not fungible goods, or I should say this court stated that lawyers are not fungible goods. There is an interest, an important interest in the clients, the litigants, being able to choose counsel. Ultimately, the court in that case noted that there would be a chilling effect on, in that case it was qualified settlement judges, but there would be a chilling effect on the ability to obtain those judges. Well, similarly, if the court doesn't clarify and doesn't ultimately explain what is allowed and what isn't allowed under NRS 1310, we're going to see a chilling effect on the ability of practicing attorneys that regularly represent individuals, the opportunity to seek office. And by doing so, I think we invite both the difficulty that we experience in the legislature with non-lawyers who don't on a regular basis speak to how laws are drafted and applied, who work with the words of the statutes. And then on top of that, we end up looking at the substantive right of voters to have someone they want to represent them in the legislature. We should be careful not to view the legislature as an abstract body, but in fact, they are people representing voters who elect every single elected official in this state.
Well, I appreciate your argument as it relates to the current candidates, but given the litigation here and a lot of the research that's been developed and the arguments that have been made, if the legislature wanted to or had a concern that this needs to be evaluated and these two exceptions plugged in, they could just as easily amend the statute in the 2019 session, which is another argument, frankly, that an opinion from this court would be advisory only.
Indeed, Your Honor, but I think that the statute as it's written is susceptible to an interpretation that ultimately says that we can adhere to the canon of constitutional avoidance by looking at the language of the statute and finding there is an opportunity for a different opinion. Now, of course, amicus counsel will probably get into more detail on this, but ultimately, when the statute was first adopted and acted in 1960, we know that some of the prior courts, the states that had preceded Nevada in establishing this, had looked at this issue and had found that there is an exception. I believe Illinois, that we based ours on, made that. And so the legislature at the time in 1960 was fully aware, at least we assume, they were fully aware of how that preceding statute had been construed by those courts. And so with that assumption, when we look at the language, for example, the fact that, and I'm reading out of sub 2 of NRS 1310, they talk about sufficient cause for the adjournment. I would submit that this is similar in language to the adequate cause in Rooney. It doesn't mean that it's necessarily mandated in all senses, but that this is sufficient to move the motion forward. And then, of course, it qualifies it in subsection 3 that the adjournment or continuance be granted without terms. So we don't qualify that. But the language, in our view, doesn't completely exclude the possibility for denial under extraordinary circumstances. And given the 1960 legislature had those facts before it when considering the Illinois statute, we would just ask this court to make that assumption.
Well, without taking the steam out of Mr. Power's argument and returning to my original point, assuming that the court, and even Mr. Beckman, seems to suggest that that's a reasonable or pragmatic approach, the concern I have is, what's the opinion in this case say? This is how we interpret it. And we interpret it in order to save its constitutionality consistent with the existence of an emergency or extraordinary circumstances. That necessarily draws the court into the debate about what this case really is all about. Who was there one? Wasn't there one? Do we remand it? Do we remand a case that's already settled? I mean, that's problematic, isn't it?
It would be. But again, I think the facts of this case tend to speak for themselves. First, in terms of the question about what does this opinion look like, I think that the court can give guidance to the lower courts through this opinion as to what constitutes an emergency. And in our view, that would be something that could not be remedied. So, for example, outside the issues of family law, where we've got something like this, where we're talking about deprivation of contact with the child, or a child relocation, for example. We want a quick answer to make sure that things that shouldn't happen don't happen. But beyond that, we've got issues of potential maybe prior restraint or disclosure of trade secrets, things that if we don't act quickly, then we can't unring the bell. It's that level of application where we cannot wait to resolve this case.
So let's suppose, for example, that counsel is counsel for a party in a major civil case, and the matter that is in front of the court is a TRO, later to be converted into a preliminary injunction, the hearing for which is going to take 2 months. It's not uncommon in complicated business court cases. Is that an exception that fits within the interpretation proposed in this circumstance?
Well, under the hypothetical, we assume, I suppose, that the movement can demonstrate that irreparable harm will obtain. So on that basis, it's essentially the same analysis, if you will, that we look at, is it truly irreparable harm? So coming back to this case, on page 20 of the appendix, of our appendix, it's the real party in interest's motion, they acknowledge that mom was already getting 2.5 days on 3 weeks out of the month. And it wasn't until mom asked for the fourth weekend that dad resisted and wanted more parenting time, wanted weekend time, that mom claimed that dad was depriving mom of her rights to her child. The reality is the court, the trial court looked at the facts of this case, she could not see obviously on the pleading, and it was almost a summary judgment type of approach where we only heard from mom's pleading. The trial court judge could not find that an emergency actually exists. Thus, she called for the evidentiary hearing. So clearly on the face of the pleadings, the emergency was not apparent. And so as we move forward, and mom is now saying she wants an extra day on those 3 weeks, she wants to go from 2.5 to 3.5 days, and then wanted that fourth weekend, and then claimed that when dad resisted, this was depriving mom of a substantial right, I don't think that that's a fair assessment. Ultimately, mom was getting time that she had negotiated. She went to pursue another relationship and voluntarily left the children with dad, and things were fine for the first several months. It wasn't until this litigation began.
But that is the nature of family court.
It is indeed.
86,000 filings statewide, the most of any area of the law. And with the court is settled with the best interests of children in the proceedings, we have expedited process to make sure that the child's best interest is served quite often in lieu of the parent's interest. Sidelight cutting into your time. I'm concerned, though, with the language of the statute itself, because it basically, despite some of our readings, the statute itself almost makes it an absolute that this continuance be given. And you, on behalf of your client, are asking for a certain amount of judicial gloss to read in language, and quite often we get criticized by the legislature for reading in gloss to statutes in their specific wording. So why should we, on this occasion, look otherwise and put this clause in? And the other concern is, if the legislature knew when they adopted it what another jurisdiction was doing, why didn't they do that to make our life much easier?
Well, having had the opportunity to observe how the sausage is made in Carson City, I can tell you that language is always a compromise, and the closest and quickest resolution is language that everyone can agree on. With respect, though, to this case, there's really two answers to your question. Number one, the gloss that we can put on really does reflect what the other courts have done. Only two of the states that considered this and struck their legislative continuance statute down ultimately returned to the direction that the trial court should, whenever possible, allow for the continuance. And in the case that we think is probably most analogous to Nevada, being the Waits case out of Texas, where their legislative session is similar to ours, they found that In most cases, it should continue, that there is this consideration of balance between the two branches. I mean, we'll never, in fact, there is no expectation. If we look at Halverson v. Hardcastle, there's no expectation of a total separation. That it's whether or not the, I believe the words were, the inherent judicial power is not infinite and ceases when the court's ability to carry out its constitutional duty to ensure the administration of justice no longer is in jeopardy. Well, in this case, we've got a statutory remedy. NRS 125C020 provides a statutory remedy, compensatory time, if the court finds that a parent has improperly deprived the other parenting time. So in this case, there is no emergency, given that she was just asking for additional time. It wasn't that Dad was cutting her off, and we think that if Dad had cut her off, similar to Waits v. Sondock, where we're talking about a situation
understand
where
the factual predicate, but as I look at the language of 1.320 and giving us the authority to kind of stretch it out or bend it when it says the fact of the judicial session is sufficient all by itself to grant the continuance. It doesn't give us this other, and I keep looking at the words on this paper, and despite our discussion, some of the words we've been using aren't there. With that, I'm going to give you 3 minutes anyway. I'm going to give counsel an additional 3 minutes at this point since we used up all your time. But at this point, we'll go to Mr. Powers for his 4 minutes before we go to...
Thank you.
Mr. Blackham.
Thank you, Your Honors. For the record, Kevin Powers, Chief Litigation Counsel of SCB Legal Division on behalf of the amicus, Nevada Legislature. The importance here is that this statute is necessary for the smooth operation of the legislature. We have a citizen legislature where its members must represent a cross-section of the community. We want lawyers to participate as much as we want doctors or waitresses or any other occupation or profession. But we know lawyers have demands from the judicial system that they have to meet. So the legislature, in this case, in 1960, passed the statute, but it wasn't the first. Illinois, in 1872, passed the first statute, and our statute is patterned after that. And that's where we pull from that case law from those jurisdictions that followed Illinois, and which was, again, Missouri after that, and then eventually Nevada. And we want to adopt their construction of the statute. That's why in 60 the legislature adopted the exact language, because we wanted to capture those prior judicial interpretations from Illinois and Missouri that had put the judicial gloss on it and said that the statute has an exception for those extraordinary cases in which a substantial right could be impaired by the continuance.
Mr. Blackham, you agree, though, plain reading of 1.310 mandates continuance. I just want to know where we're starting from. Plain reading.
Generally, because Illinois and Missouri looked at it and found it to be mandatory early on, then I would say, yes, that is the plain reading. However, Wisconsin has the same statute, and they did not read it to be mandatory. That was a 2003 case. But because the legislature adopted those Illinois and Missouri rules, it is mandatory.
If we find it's mandatory, in absence of some other intervention by this court, would you indicate then that it's unconstitutional?
I would not say it's unconstitutional on its face, because it can be applied to those cases that are run-of-the-mill cases, ordinary cases, where there's not an emergency. It can be mandatory. You can take away that discretion in those cases because there's no harm to the plan. So I'd say it's not unconstitutional in space. But I would say there is a constitutional question as applied to emergency circumstances. Turning to Justice Hardesty's question on mootness, I would ask the court to look to its own case in Sarks-Tarzanian versus legislature from 1998. There the question was whether a legislative committee could close its meetings during a legislative session to the public, and it in fact did. But this court didn't decide that issue until after the session was long over. It then decided we're going to give an opinion on that issue because it's an important issue of law, even though the underlying case was moot. This is the same thing here. Although this underlying case is moot, this is an important case that needs to be resolved because it's going to continue. And obviously, the legislature is made up sometimes of 20% of lawyers, and there's going to be this issue arising in future legislative sessions. And indeed, some of the cases from the other jurisdictions, there was a mootness issue in those cases, in particular Vario Healthcare, a 2016 case from California. There, the court decided that it would address the legislative continuance statute even though the underlying case had become moot. The importance of this statute to the legislature is important not just as an institutional aspect, but also because it affects all of their constituents. When a legislator isn't present in Carson City, then a whole section of the state, those constituents represented by the legislature, is not being represented in the legislature at that time. So it's important for the legislature to have this ability to ensure its members are present and available in Carson City. Some of the other concerns raised by the justices seem to be focusing on why doesn't the legislature simply amend the statute in 2019? That's certainly a possibility, but this is the statute that's before the court now, and there's no guarantee in the legislative process that an amendment can occur. There's always different factors that occur in the legislative process that prevent a bill from being passed. But this is the current law, and this law has been in existence, not in this state, but in other states, for over 100 years, and we ask that the court interpret it in a constitutional manner. The statute is constitutional on its face. The judicial gloss from the other states existed when the legislature adopted the statute, so we ask that the court provide that judicial gloss and provide an exception, a narrow one, only for those emergency circumstances. Thank you.
Mr. Powers, thank you, and I'll remember your closing words that the court should consider the judicial gloss in our other proceedings.
Thank you, Your Honor.
With that, Mr. Blackham, and you have 20 minutes so you can respond to both arguments.
Good morning, and may it please the court. We're asking the court to strike down NRS 1.310, Nevada's legislative continuing statute, because it violates the separation of powers doctrine. The statute mandates that courts grant continuances of judicial proceedings in all cases. There is, in which an attorney legislature was retained prior to the start of the legislative session. It doesn't give courts who are subject to this statute any discretion to carve out exceptions in cases where there may be an emergency or a litigant has a substantial right infringed upon or defeated. The Justice Douglas pointed out, I thought it was very appropriate in this case, he said that that it's pretty much absolute. You don't have the opportunity under the plain language of the statute to exercise any discretion. But I would argue that more than absolute, more than almost absolute, it is truly absolute. This court's obliged to apply the plain meaning of words, and the plain meaning, it makes it clear that the fact of the legislators. Being elected and serving in the legislature is sufficient for the court to grant that continuance, and then there'll be the continuance then, quote, must be given without condition. In the briefings and a little bit in oral argument, there was reference made to Illinois and Missouri cases that counsel represented that our statute was modeled on. Those cases interpreted statutes in those states that our state supposedly modeled its continuing statutes on. But when you actually look at the statutes that are analyzed in the cases, and Kiger from Missouri, K-Y-G-E-R, and then Theodorin from Illinois, those statutes include provisions that our legislature did not see fit to include in our statute. And they're important because they give rise to the discretion that has been argued here. It's not that the court in those cases determined that an emergency would be sufficient to insert language that does not exist into the statute. Instead, the courts weighed the facts of the case and decided that they had the right to determine whether the sufficient cause was met. And I can tell you that if you look at the Kiger case, I'll just quote from it, but it's page 48 The statute is quoted in that case, and it says, when the General Assembly is in session, it shall be a sufficient cause for continuance if it shall appear to the court by affidavit that any party applying for such continuance or any attorney, solicitor, or counsel of such party is a member of the other House, of either the House or the General Assembly, and the actual attendance of on the session of the same and the attendance of such party, attorney, solicitor, or counsel is necessary to a fair and proper trial or other proceedings in such suit. Our statute contains no such qualifiers. And the issues in these cases, and I represent that's Missouri and the Illinois statute is very similar. The issue in those cases was, does the attorney filing an affidavit that says those conditions were met, is that sufficient to grant the continuance? Does the court have the discretion to ask for more? And the courts did find that it did have that discretion, because an attorney can't testify, or a witness cannot testify to statutory requirements having been met. The court has that discretion. And so rather than inserting language that didn't exist, the court addressed a gaping, a hole in the statute that required interpretation. Our statute has no such hole. Our statute is very clear that there is absolutely no discretion permitted. And then if you look at the legislative history, that's borne out. The intent of the amendments in 2001 was to make it clear that not only did the statute apply to trials, but the statute also applied to all proceedings related to litigation, including discovery, depositions, etc. And so it was also addressed, which I think is important given the language that we are comparing in Illinois and Missouri. It's also important to note that in the debates, it was discussed that this was intended for the benefit of solo practitioners, not for folks with multiple attorneys in their offices, and that if another attorney could be assigned to the case, then that may be sufficient for the stay not to be granted, the continuance not to be granted. In fact, interestingly, in Theodoran, in the Theodoran case, that comes up as well towards the end of the opinion. It's addressed that the affidavit did not state sufficiently whether or not there were other people in the office who could do it. And that's important, because what does it mean to have the choice of an attorney? I don't believe that I've seen the fee agreement from Mr. Pickard's firm, but my expectation is that if I were to look at it, the client would have been retaining the firm, not necessarily Mr. Pickard directly. Again, I can't speak for sure, but I know that's typically the case. And we also know that there was at least one other case that my firm was involved where an associate from Mr. Pickard's office actually substituted and the case progressed, and there was no request for a continuance made. And so I think that it's important to look at the fact that there is absolutely no ambiguity in the statute. And when you apply the plain meaning, it's clearly in violation of the co-equal branch, the judiciary's right to make rules and govern its courtroom and ensure that there's speedy access to justice on the part of litigants. This statute doesn't allow that to happen. That's the support for a finding that this statute is unconstitutional on its face, but at a minimum, it's unconstitutional as applied. And certainly, there are fundamental rights that are implicated in this case when it comes to the care and custody of minor children. And this court's found that the court's concern as to the best interest of children is paramount. I know that counsel argued earlier that there was no emergency, and that Judge Marquis actually denied didn't see fit to deny the requested continuance because there was no emergency on its face. There was nothing in the minute order that suggested that.
Thank you.
There was nothing in the minute order to suggest that. In fact, what happened was Judge Marquis saw that that this clearly mandatory statute was invoked. Mr. Pickard's application cited that it was mandatory and had to be granted. The position has evolved a little bit over time, but the evidentiary hearing was set to determine the merits of my client Misty's counter motion, and Mr. Pickard was again given the opportunity to send an associate or to appear telephonically, and it was specifically stated that it was going to be a short evidentiary hearing. So it is really unclear what, if any, impact this would have had on the legislature's ability to do business. The fact of the matter is that there were substantial concerns borne out by the facts that the children were not being properly cared for. My client's time was actually being whittled away. One can argue whether or not any preliminary schedule was agreed to because of the manner in which it was presented, and I would offer that another interpretation would be it was my way or the highway. But be that as it may, as time progressed, the restrictions became increased, and the children were obviously not being cared for the way that they should be cared for. This gave rise to legitimate concerns on the part of my client, and we tried to avail ourselves of the court. And because of this continuance, we were unable to do that, and there were months at a time that were lost between a parent and child. And in the Sims case, this court pointed out that while adults may have a certain view of time as being, let's just say that 4 months to a child is a much larger percentage of that child's life than it is to an adult's life, and the perception would bear that out. And so to suggest that the duration of the legislative session, which is 120 days ordinarily, is a brief continuance, and leaving the status quo in place, irrespective of whether the child's best interests are being met, to say that's not an emergency, that doesn't entail extraordinary circumstances, I just believe it's just improper and it's inaccurate. The court has to make orders that are in the child's best interest, and that's exactly what was required in this case. That's exactly what was denied to Misty.
That the court set, was that as to the constitutionality of the statute, or was that to look at the reasonableness of this? Because it sounds almost like the court was interpreting the statute the way Mr. Powers is asking us to interpret the statute.
I get the sense from the briefings that there is definitely an analogy between what Mr. Powers is advocating for and what Judge Marquis did, and that's one of the peculiarities of where this case wound up, was that it appears that Judge Marquis did exactly what the Legislative Council Bureau believes that she should have done, but for the fact that their focus appears to be on affidavits and submitting evidence without an evidentiary hearing. It's unclear from the briefings from the Legislative Council Bureau whether there's ever an occasion in which they believe it would be appropriate to hold an evidentiary hearing.
If we would not find the statute unconstitutional, what would you want the disposition to say that would be favorable to your client?
The disposition would say that it should be routinely granted absent an emergency, and it would be subject to the court's discretion, and that the initial stage would entail presenting affidavits and any supporting evidence or office of proof at that point. In support of the opposition to the motion. Sorry.
Mr. Blackham, I'm sorry, did you complete your answer to Justice Cherry? Because I had another follow-up question.
But if the court believed that an evidentiary hearing was required, the court would also have the discretion to set an evidentiary hearing.
So the interesting part of that interpretation is that would diverge from what the legislature's offering and what Mr. Pickard's offered as their interpretation, the so-called judicial gloss to be attached. What you're suggesting is that a statute that says outright that the judge is supposed to grant the continuance would now be interpreted as placing a burden on the legislature to demonstrate, that there's some emergency here that has to be satisfied in the legislature before the continuance is granted. Is that, am I interpreting what you said correctly?
I apologize. Perhaps my my coughing made my point unclear. What actually meant was the opposite, was that it would be the opposing party, the person opposing the motion for continuance, who would show such facts. I do believe that the legislature...
So your interpretation is kind of consistent with your response to the show cause order. It's similar to what is being advocated by Mr. Powers, that it sounds like.
I think some of the key differences would be, number one, I don't get the sense that evidentiary hearings are permissible under Mr. Powers' interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps just as important...
But there would have to be an affidavit that illustrates the basis for the emergency or other extreme circumstance to warrant a hearing going forward.
Yes, I think that the legislator should have to make the prima facie showing similar to what's required in Illinois and in Missouri, and also include in that statement that they, them as a person, as an attorney, not necessarily in any other capacity, they are required in order for justice to be effected in that case.
Well, so the judge didn't engage in this process. So the judge simply said that the statute's unconstitutional by virtue of the separation of powers, or is, and as a consequence, proceeded with the hearing. As you pointed out, I don't read the record as the judge finding any emergency here. She simply proceeded with the hearing.
Is that
correct?
No, my understanding is that she actually set it for an evidentiary hearing so that she could make a determination concerning whether the request for a continuance should be denied based upon the circumstances identified in our opposition and counter motion to Mr. Pickard's motion to continue.
Uh-huh.
And that hearing never went forward because the writ petition was filed the day before that hearing was to take place. So I believe, yes, she did find it unconstitutional, but she nevertheless went through a process that would have given both sides their day in court and would have been able to testify as to the facts that support both of their sides. But in fact, she painted it.
But the basis under which she found it to be unconstitutional is no longer being advocated by any party sitting here.
I believe that it's unconstitutional. I focused my argument on the areas that were raised.
So you're sticking with that argument?
Absolutely. I don't believe it's key. The words aren't there.
Okay. All right. So I just want to be clear.
I think it's akin to a shoehorn.
So let's turn the... So assuming that we stick with that argument, what's your view about why this isn't moot? I mean, you would advocate in response to Justice Jerry's question that we would conclude that it's unconstitutional as violative of separation of powers, but is it necessary to reach that given the fact that the case, and I guess you agree, the case is resolved?
Well, my understanding of the reason why we had the oral argument today is because it is capable of repetition. Everybody here appears to believe that that's a... Well, you may not agree.
That's why I'm asking you. Do you agree with that?
In my response to the order to show cause, I believe I had similar concerns. Although obviously I think the disposition should be very different.
Yeah.
I do believe that it should be disposed of. I think it's a very important issue, and I think I do agree with Mr. Pickard that we could expect these requests for continuances to come up next year.
Let me inquire, if the statute were to be stricken, it doesn't relieve the court of the obligation to do a good cause analysis if somebody's asking for a continuance based upon service in the legislature, correct?
That is correct. The court still has the ability, and that's part of the problem, is that the discretion of the judge to conduct and operate the courtroom as he or she sees fit has been taken away, and that's the violation of the separation of powers. But absolutely, if there was not good cause for a continuance, the judge could certainly deny it. But I can't understate the importance of the fact that that reading the glossing over is really more than glossing over here. What's being proposed is inserting language that's inconsistent with the plain language of the statute. And my expectation is that If the court were to do as we ask and strike the statute down, that the contingency that you referred to will probably come about, and that the statute will be passed next year with language that more closely mirrors the actual statutes that it was supposedly modeled on, and that requires specific showings and gives a litigant who is subject to possible harm a remedy. We do have a statutory remedy, as Mr. Pickard pointed out, which would allow the court to provide makeup time, but you can't get those days back. It's not sufficient. If it's all you've got, the litigant's certainly going to pursue it, but it's not going to take up the time that's lost. Those 4 months will never come back, and it's just insufficient to say that it's inaccurate to say that you've not made a prima facie showing of irreparable harm when you simply say that the children are not being cared for properly and one of the parents is being deprived of time to which they believe the children are, that parent believes is best for the children to have. And
if the hearing hadn't proceeded, this could have been 6 or 7 months later from the time the motion was made.
Well, it was interim orders that were being requested, so certainly a resolution of the entire case, but the lead day request for relief, I expect would have been heard sometime in the summer, but as I indicated in my brief, I anticipated that the additional time may have been requested to file an opposition because clearly that wasn't being worked on during the legislative session.
And you'd rather leave that completely to the discretion of a judge as to whether or not to grant the continuance to a legislator rather than to have a statute with flaws? Judicial flaws, is that the word we use? No, that's a new one on me.
No,
flaws, not flaws.
Oh, Paul, I'm sorry.
I don't believe totally to the discretion. I believe that there... I see my time.
Go ahead and finish your statement.
I believe that the legislature can certainly set out a criteria that would allow the court to exercise the discretion that it's entitled to exercise to make a decision that's appropriate in both cases. I think that's the balancing act that's being requested here.
Well, just remember, we have a legislature that has a 120-day time frame, and when 1960, they used to go into the winter, you know, as far as legislative sessions. So at least if there's an emergency in May, you know that sometime in June, everybody's going to be home.
May I respond?
Please.
It's important to also keep in mind, though, that this not only affects lower court proceedings, but would also affect the appellate court proceedings. And there could be a writ petition before you in a case where an attorney legislator is counsel of record. And based on the statute's language, and even if you read the legislative history, it's specifically stated it would apply. And the proceedings of this court would also be arrested.
Well, we have video conferencing, so they'd have to just walk next door to on Carson, on 201 South Carson, and the other people could come here and we could handle it, just like Justice Perigary being in Carson right now.
We have one
modern technology.
Just one more question, because I want to just follow up on that point. How broadly do we construe this as written? Is this a 120-day adjournment from meeting filing deadlines, filing a notice of appeal, response? Yeah, is it just a 120-day stay if we give fidelity to the statute?
I think if we give fidelity to the statute, it's going to be for the duration of the legislative session. I don't believe the language of the statute spells out the length of the session. So if the session length were to change, that would necessarily allow the length of the continuance to change.
Well, we've had several legislative sessions that have had successive extra sessions, too. So special sessions.
That's another problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Pickard?
Thank you. I will begin with the last comment that was made by Justice Hardesty with respect to the special sessions. I would also point out that those sessions, special sessions, typically last a day or two, maybe three. They're usually quite short. And they're relatively rare, given that it takes either three-fifths of the legislature to call one or the governor can call one, and it's typically one issue only. or at least a limited number of issues. So in the ordinary sense, I don't believe that that would create much of an additional burden. However, when we are talking about striking the statute and then leaving it up to judicial discretion, what we invite is a very different outcome depending upon the judge's individual beliefs as to the importance of the legislature and their work. What we're asking for is a unified rule that this court would give to the district courts in terms of assessing what is and what is not sufficient grounds for the continuance. Ultimately, it's a definitional question. I would point out that in the 2001 the colloquy, when the amendments in 2001 were provided, that Assemblyman Brower suggested that AB 148, which was the bill that considered the amendment, would see that a legislator was not forced from session involvement. However, the new language would preclude a party from obtaining a continuance simply by finding a lawyer legislator mid-session. So clearly, the legislators were considering the effect and how this statute would apply, and they didn't write all of that in. And so I believe...
Well, why should we write all that in for them? I mean, to me, this mootness issue is of great concern because generally we do better when we have sharp, fixed facts that we're addressing and trying to apply law to. And here we're being told about writs and all kinds of ways in which we can fix this statute. Why should we do that other than the legislature?
And that's a great point. Ultimately, I think that because the legislature didn't put that language in, even though it was before the legislature at the time. They chose on words that they thought would get the job done. But there was certainly a broader sense of understanding of what those words meant at the time. And so similar to how we view...
Well, I'd like to comment on that, if sure. I could, or ask you a question about that, Mr. Baker, because Mr. Powers made the same point. I did not see in the briefs any reference to the legislative history in 1960 that would provide us with assurance that that was the intention of the legislature. That is an assumed statement in the brief, but there's nothing in the 1960 legislative history that demonstrates that we're going to follow the holdings in Illinois and elsewhere.
I see I'm out of time.
Go ahead. You're free to answer the question.
Ultimately, that's correct. The legislative history didn't exist. They didn't keep those minutes
sure.
in 1960. And so I think we go back on standard statutory construction where we assume that they knew what was out there. We do know from the record from the other states what was out there. And so we assume that they knew that at the time. So ultimately, all we're asking is that this court do what the other courts, the majority of courts that have addressed this issue, have done, and that's define sufficient cause and the underlying statute to allow for.
This is rebuttal, so I would like you to address one argument that Mr. Blackham makes. He cited the Wisconsin case. I think even the Illinois case has some language in their statute going back to the time when it was interpreted that left some room for the courts in those cases to, we've characterized it here as judicial gloss, but at least interpret the statute that would allow for some emergency determination or emergency, I'll call it, exception to the absoluteness of the statute. We don't have that in our statute. What's your view about Mr. Blackham's comment that these other prior holdings are operating on statutes with some, I'll call it, wiggle room?
And the way I read those cases is to provide the support for their underlying decisions. Each state's statutes have evolved over time, and our statutes addressed in 2001 in these amendments took us down a different path as well. So to the extent that those cases departed from what we had, particularly after 1960, we're going to see some necessary and understandable deviations in the arguments. But ultimately, they all came to the same conclusion, which is that the judiciary, I mean, that there, and we've, in our own jurisprudence, we've held that the ideas that the co-equal branches stand completely independent of each other without influence of the other just is, it's a canard. It doesn't actually work that way. We see Title 14 of the NRS statutes controlling criminal procedure in great detail, and yet there's no call for that being stricken. We see the legislature tolling litigation in other contexts. We do see there's quite a bit of overlap, and so this is an issue of comedy, if you will, between the branches to allow the statute to protect the legislative interest. Because again, this isn't just a abstract body. These are the statutory or the substantive rights of voters to have their representative speak for them at the various hearings and particularly the back room, that's the wrong statement, but the caucus discussions, for example, when we're discussing how we feel about the...
But, Council, as you go down that line, it puts you in a very awkward position because earlier you talked about sometimes it's not written a particular way so that people will agree to sign it, to pass it. Mm. So the question, without that legislative history, were words left out so that people, in fact, would sign what is now codified before us, that they might not have wanted that extra. We don't know. I'm not going to suppose. But that is a concern. You're out of time, but sum up why we should sustain that position, and we'll bring this to an end this day, but we will have homework to do.
Thank you. I appreciate that. At the end of the day, I think what this case stands for, and the reason I think that it's important to get a decision and not find that the case is moot and not provide an opinion, is to afford and ultimately balance the rights of citizens, of voters, to have their representative in the intense 120-day session versus those of an individual litigant. And at the end of the day, it is a balance. If it's not an emergency, if it's an emergency and truly irreparable harm will obtain, then I don't think there's anyone in the room that thinks that the continuance should be granted. But unless there is truly irreparable harm, one that cannot be remedied, whether through statutory reparations or some judicially crafted remedy, where that's just not possible, then I think that there's no question it doesn't survive. When that is possible, I think that we allow the voters to have their representative present during the legislative session. And as several comments have been made, sometimes the litigation, particularly in highly contested matters, take far more than 120 days to resolve.
The court thanks the parties for the arguments given this day. This is an important issue as to our citizen legislature and the right of parties to be heard in a timely manner. With that, we stand in recess. We have a public